You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Nora Vincent refers to herself as an immersion journalist. For her first book, she wanted to explore the male experience, so she lived, worked, and dated as a man for more than a year. For her next project, Ms. Vincent found herself wanting to learn more about the shortfalls of mental health care, so she had herself committed to three different psychiatric institutions. And she tells that story in Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. It's published by Viking, and I'm delighted that it has brought Nora Vincent back to the show. Hi, good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
And let's start with some background. After your first book, Self-Made Man, which became a bestseller, you fell into a deep depression. Was that after you came on the show to talk about it?
You did it. You were responsible. I did, yeah. Toward the end of writing that book, the trauma, I guess, or really, I guess I would say emotional exhaustion of trying to be a man really got to me.
And so you were doing the whole promotional circuit depressed?
Well, I came out of the worst of it because what I did was I checked myself into this first place that I went into legitimately. And then it took me another, say, 6 months to recover. And during that time, that was right before the publicity. So I had had plenty of time. But I had really determined already that I was going to probably work on this next book.
And what was it about that experience at that psychiatric facility that made you want to write a book about it?
Well, a couple things. The first is really that going there and realizing I wanted to find help, and I had been told that I would find help there. And the fact that I actually felt a lot worse when I left made me think, you know, there are a lot of other people out there who must be in this kind of circumstance where they want to get help and they aren't getting it.
But were you concerned at all that researching Voluntary Madness might be unhealthy for you? Had you seen Samuel Fuller's film Shock Carter, for example?
Yeah, I actually did a bunch of research where I saw a lot of those films, which, yeah, I mean, and just having been there myself and knowing how it made me feel after only 4 days, the idea of going back to several places and really places that I think would, you know, I thought would be scarier and not knowing if I could get out or when. Yeah, that's what took me so long to decide to write the book.
Well, how do you protect yourself during this kind of research?
Well, you go in with, luckily I'd been to one before, so I knew that, for example, I developed a yoga routine because I knew that I wouldn't have access to the outdoors or any kind of real exercise, and that really is a mainstay for me. I brought books that I love, sort of the Desert Island books. I meditated. I just tried to, you know, and also where I could, I tried to bring in some kind of snacks and things that were healthy because I also know that that helps to make me feel better. So I prepared a little bit.
And you decided to explore three different hospitals. How did you choose which ones?
Well, I wanted to do an urban public hospital, and then I wanted to do a rural. Well, really what led me to the second place is in the urban public hospital, I ended up with mostly people of color, and it was mostly psychotic people and indigent people. So I wanted there, after that, to really get a contrast. So I did some research to find the whitest place that I could find, a rural, wanted a private hospital, hopefully a small clinic, and that's what I ended up finding because I assumed that the experience would be different, and certainly it was. It was mostly depressed and addicted patients.
And then a third one was an alternative hospital.
Yeah, I wanted to go someplace where this place was one of the few places I found that didn't have locked wards, could allow you really the emphasis on therapy and individual attention.
How difficult is it to get oneself committed? If I decided I want to do research and get myself committed to a mental hospital, could I just go and say I'm depressed?
Yeah, or you could say I'm hearing voices. And in fact, there was an experiment 30 years ago that was done that was very much like that, where a psychologist and his, you know, grad students committed themselves, just went to various places. You could go, I guarantee you, if you went to five different places, you would get into all of them. And you could eat, and they'd diagnose you as a psychotic if you said you were hearing voices, and they'd give you that medication.
How were you diagnosed?
I went in just saying that I was depressed and suicidal, and I was given the depressive suicidal diagnosis and medicated or attempted to be medicated accordingly.
In each hospital, the same?
Yeah.
Did the hospitals check your background? Did they call your outside doctors or therapists, for example?
Well, they certainly asked for some of that information, but I was reluctant to give it because even though I was going in under my own name, I really didn't want to be discovered as an immersion journalist because, of course, I'd already done Self-Made Man.
And none of them had read your book, even though it was a bestseller, or had read
your
columns?
Yeah, it turned out at one place, not the psychiatrist or any of the admitting people, but the psychologist told me at the end of my time when I told her, well, you know, look, I'm going to write about this experience. And she said, well, you know, I should tell you that I knew who you were when you came through the door and I'd read your book. But I thought you were genuinely here because you were depressed, because I knew at the end of that book that you had been depressed. Mm-hmm. So that worked in my favor.
Some people might have read some of those columns you wrote for the New York Press and decided that you should be put into a hospital.
You had to say that, didn't you?
I did. What about insurance? Do you have to have health insurance to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital?
Well, it depends. I mean, some of these places, the second place I went, they claimed that that wasn't the case, but it seemed pretty clear to me that they were very careful about making sure you had it before they even gave you the interview. And there was actually a joke that went around that somebody said, well, you know, if a patient said, if you want to get out of here, just cancel your insurance.
And it doesn't matter whether it's the public hospital or private hospital?
Well, the public hospitals, as far as I understand it, have to take everybody. So, you know, in fact, the majority of the patients there didn't have insurance. Mm-hmm. And that's actually how, when I first went into the public hospital, I didn't want to submit insurance. I wanted them to bill me directly for the stay. And what they do is they put you into the system to request Medicaid, and then they can find out that you do, in fact, have insurance. And even though I said, I just want you to bill me directly, they didn't, which is a funny story because then it ended up going through my insurance company, and I tried to call them to reimburse them, and they thought I was nuts.
And this doesn't have any effect on your insurance?
Well, as far as I know, it hasn't yet, because I made every effort to try to, you know, call them and say, I really want to pay you. And they really didn't know what to do with that. And they literally, I'm not kidding, they thought that because some people do try to have their records expunged or they deny that they needed to be in this facility. And so they really thought that I might very well have been psychotic, and they couldn't take what I was saying for, you know, real.
My guest is Nora Vincent. Her latest book, Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin. Were you at all scared when you checked in? Because, you know, you're giving up pretty much all your rights, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. And it's strange how you learn when you're there the petty deprivations that really do a number on you very quickly. And even though I knew I was going in to do this job, it took 24 hours in the first place for me to start to feel genuinely depressed and terrified.
Well, you wrote that. You were afraid that you'd become them, afraid that maybe lying with your face to the wall could make you into a person who lies with his face to the wall.
Exactly. And that, you know, I tried to ask myself those questions. Does the place make the people, or do the people make the place? And that was a question that went throughout. And it really did, no matter, you know, people said, well, you knew you were there. You knew you were going to get out. But I didn't know when or how I would get out. I had my publisher, you know, type up a letter that was on their letterhead in case of an emergency. But, you know, if you say to somebody, Google me, you know, I'm actually a journalist. I mean, plenty of people do that. They, you know, that's delusions of grandeur.
Well, it's also the matter of getting sick in a hospital. People often get sick when they go to a hospital for another illness because it's where all the germs are. I don't know whether that affects people when they're in a mental facility.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's a similar, yeah, staph infections that are fatal are often contracted in hospitals. And it's a similar, being around other sick people, excuse me, is not really particularly healthy. It's not like being, I say this in the second part, of being around other alcoholics, for example, can be very helpful in talking through things. Being in a group of other depressives and talking about these things, generally speaking, especially when you're in the throes of the depression, doesn't usually help.
Were you taking medication when you entered Meriwether, the first hospital you write about in the book? I'm assuming Meriwether is a made-up name.
Yeah, all these are made-up names. I was on a very small dose of medication, and I did not want to be on anything else, even though they pressed very hard to have me do that. And in fact, I became very frightened that they weren't going to let me out. You know, they would keep me longer because I wasn't being cooperative. So I accepted the medication, and then I just ended up throwing it in the toilet.
Is there an effort to get patients in and out quickly?
To some degree, yeah.
And because that's the case with medical hospitals. They give you the medicine, and they say, okay, you're better. Could you leave? We need the bed.
Yeah, in a sense, that was true, although I think what I found is a revolving door policy, it seemed to me, that they were taking these people off the streets for disturbing the peace, over-medicating them, and then really sending them out with no better coping skills, and then they would go off the meds because of the side effects, and they'd be back in again.
Well, you said you never took the meds, but you were depressed. Mm-hmm. Don't medications help depress people? I've known any number of people who need to be on some meds just to maintain themselves.
Yeah, there's no question that they help many people, and they helped me. The question that I have really is more about what does help mean? How is it helping? And what else is it doing to your body besides changing the levels of serotonin in your brain? I mean, this is very poorly understood. We don't really know all the effects that these things are having. We're not telling people when we put them on them, you know, if you try to get off this drug or you want to get off it, you're going to have a really hard time doing so. There's a lot
You're saying they're addictive?
Well, I mean, people will deny the classic definition of addiction, but I can only tell you that in my experience, I went off several of these drugs and I had terrible, terrible withdrawal and rebound effects that have been, you know, reported all over the internet, other people who've experienced this.
You got off the drugs at one point because you wanted to write about what it was like to feel depressed, but I assume that, from what I know from talking to people who are depressed, that it's hard to do anything when you're depressed. So how did you work
that out?
Well,
that's what I wanted to do in this book. It's not just about these institutions. It's about my own struggle, and I wanted to write about depression in real time. And one of the great mercies of depression is really that once you're out of it, you don't really remember what it was like. You know it was really bad, but you don't remember the details. And I didn't want to reflect back and say, well, this is how it felt then. I wanted to say, this is what I'm doing right now.
What drugs were you taking? Are you willing to tell us?
Yeah, I was taking Prozac. I had taken many other drugs over the course of time and found them to be much more difficult. Prozac, in fact, was the reason I went back to it is that when you're getting off some of these other drugs that have a much shorter half-life in your system, Prozac can help to reduce some of these withdrawal problems, which was...
But it doesn't work with everybody. In fact, none of these drugs work with everybody.
Right. And again, the question is, do they work? How are they working? What are they doing that when you say something helps, you may feel better, but it's a myth that it's correcting a chemical imbalance. It's not. It's creating a chemical imbalance that happens to make you feel good.
But isn't depression the result of a chemical imbalance?
We don't know. I mean, that's one of the myths, you know. I mean, there are many people who have written about this, that serotonin deficiencies do not cause depression, that's not actually true, and that we don't understand the mechanism very well. We do understand, or we've seen, that an excess of serotonin can make you feel good. But again, what you're doing is you're masking the problem. And, you know, you give anybody ecstasy, for example, they're going to feel good, but that doesn't mean you've actually corrected the problem.
Well, what alternative would you see to the pharmaceuticals?
Well, you know, sometimes, as you say, there are cases where I think people are chemically depressed, or, you know, we don't understand it well enough to know for sure. But there are also a lot of cases where people are being overdiagnosed. You know, the number of actually chemically depressed people out there and the number of people who are diagnosed as such, there's a great discrepancy. And I think there's a lot of help to be gained in other ways. Before people just run to the meds, I think they could explore a lot of therapy and so on.
Well, some experts say that antidepressants won't do any good unless you really are depressed.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say. I mean, some people say that if they actually work, then yeah, you may not actually be depressed. You know, so there's controversy about what makes them work and not.
Well, I want to return to this after we take a little break. My guest is Nora Vincent. Her latest book, Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin, published by Viking. Stay with us. We're back with Nora Vincent, the author of the New York Times bestseller Self-Made Man. She's also written a nationally syndicated op-ed column for the Los Angeles Times, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, the New Republic, the Village Voice, the Washington Post, among other publications. And her new book is called Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin, published by Viking. We were getting into the fact that this book really paints a pretty negative picture of psychopharmaceuticals and the drug companies that produce them. Are you against ultimately using drugs to treat mental illness?
No, I'm not.
Because you kind of suggest that psychiatrists and other mental health practitioners are in cahoots with the drug companies.
Well, they clearly are. I mean, this is coming out all the time. Not all of them, but, I mean, there have been numerous articles showing that a lot of them are actually being paid directly by the drug companies, being sent on junkets and so on. This is clearly a relationship that exists, and it's a corrupt one in my view and a lot of people's views.
But they're not just pushing the psychopharmaceuticals. They're pushing all the drugs. I mean, There's a thing in the Times the other day, a guy who had a whole wall of, filled with pens that he'd received.
That's right. There's a lot of swag at the APA, I'll tell you. And there is a very close relationship.
I do need another pen.
But, you know, I think it's not that across the board. I mean, look, there are different doctors. What I found is that a lot of people don't question their doctors, and they assume this person is a competent, has my best interests at heart, doesn't have a relationship that he hasn't disclosed, and so on. Also, I think just the way that the doctors are trained, they're trained to sort of automatically go to the meds.
Well, in the hospitals you were patients ever given a choice about whether or not to take medication?
Well, I mean, you know, they really push it, and then there were cases in which people were forcibly medicated if they were making a disturbance and so on. But, you know, I think they very much pushed it on me, and I didn't want to take it. And as I say, I was afraid not to.
Did they tell you about side effects?
No. In fact, I asked them about, well, you know, what neurotransmitter does this work on? And they said, well, we'll have to get back to you. We're not sure.
Really?
You know, I mean, this is.
And some of the drugs make you put on weight, or they make you really hungry. Did they warn you about that?
No. I mean, you know, when I was first put on these drugs 10 years ago, I was not warned in any way about any of the side effects that I would experience. And that's part of what I'm saying. I'm not against the use of these drugs. And as I say, they do help a lot of people. And I'm not going to make an across-the-board statement. But what I do want is people to be informed consumers. And they shouldn't rely on their doctors to inform them, although the doctor should be better about saying, here's what you need to know if you decide to go on this drug.
Rather than just trust me.
Yeah, this arrogant attitude, I know what's best, take this and just get out of my office.
You talk in the book about mental hospitals being a revolving door. What do you think psychiatric facilities need to do to end that cycle?
Well, the difficulty that I came to in the end is that a lot of this has to do with the person's ability and willingness to partake in his or her own treatment.
So it's not just the hospital's fault.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I went in with that prejudice, I suppose, or I wanted to show that that was the case, and I came away realizing that a lot of it does have to do. It's not that there aren't improvements that should be made and better alternatives. I think one of the things we should be doing better is offering people more coping skills, getting at the things that are really the stressors that are in place so that when they go out of the hospital, they don't just run back into the same wall they ran into before and end up coming back in. But I think that this isn't the emphasis in a lot of places, and that's one of the problems.
Does a patient's resources, financial and otherwise, affect the recovery?
I think so. That's what I saw. And I think a lot of it has to do with a social network. A lot of these people that I saw in the first place were worse off because they had fallen out the bottom of society and they didn't have this family structure or other people that they could rely on. And I certainly found the most high-functioning, for example, psychotics that I met were people who actually, one of them had a job in the clinic that I was in. She'd been given a job as a kind of a consultant or you know, I guess somebody who could talk to the patients in an unofficial capacity as a former patient. And I thought that was a very helpful way to include this person, give her a sense of mission. And she was clearly much more high-functioning as a result. Family can have a very similar effect.
And friends.
And friends, yeah.
Well, how much do you feel willpower and the desire to get well and stay well come into play?
Well, for me, and this is probably going to be the most unpopular thing I say in the book, I don't buy this idea that depression is just a disease, you can't do anything. It's like saying diabetes is a disease, therefore you can't do anything about it. That's not true. You can change aspects of your lifestyle that will make you better, will make it easier to deal with this.
This is the Tom Cruise argument.
Well, not to that extent. I mean, he denies that these things even really exist. I think the jury is still out, clearly, about what the mechanism of mental illness is. Clearly, it exists as a phenomenon. The question is, we need to understand it better. But I would never, and he also would claim that you should never use drugs of any kind. And I'm not saying that at all. I think sometimes it's just the best we have. I hope we can do better.
And there's a big difference between depression, straight depression, bipolar depression, psychotic depression, or psychoses.
Mm-hmm. Well, and wouldn't it be nice if you went into a hospital and they had an ability to pinpoint what you have? I mean, the problem right now is that we're reasoning backward from symptoms so that, you know, if you went into a hospital and said you were having terrible chest pain, it turns out to be gas, but you think you're having a heart attack. You know, we need some way to determine how do you actually have this thing?
But depression does run in families, doesn't it? Which would suggest at least that it's partly genetic.
Yeah, and there's no question, I think, you know, every state of emotional you know, let's say you're happy. That's a chemical state in your brain. We don't understand that chemical state, but clearly it is. So I don't doubt in any way that there is, that it is chemical. The question is, how is it affected? Can, you know, things that I'm saying to you right now are having a chemical effect on your brain. Same with, you know, I mean, it's very complicated.
What do you think about talk therapy? Do you think that that can work alone, or does it work at all as far as you're concerned?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think it works. I think really intense therapy that really tries to take apart your experience and get at what may be causing the initial reaction. I mean, this is something I go into in the third part, the idea of a wellness model versus a pathology model, where you might actually say, look, you know, I've just gone through a divorce and my mother has died and all these things have happened. There are reasons for why I might be feeling awful. It doesn't mean that it isn't a chemical event in my brain, but it may be an event caused by circumstances.
You went to three different hospitals. Did all of them offer talk therapy?
No, only two of them did.
Mm-hmm. The more expensive ones,
yeah.
Not the state facility.
Right.
My guest is Nora Vincent. Her book, Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin, which is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the other hospitals, which were more expensive, had different treatment philosophies?
Well, actually, the second hospital, the bill came almost to the same amount as the first hospital, which I also found interesting and may have to do with it being a private doctor-owned facility. So actually, the costs were an interest. And the last place was actually cheaper. Granted, you'd be paying it out of pocket often, although they did start accepting insurance. But that was also interesting to me, that you were actually staying. I stayed there for 2 weeks, and it was less than half the cost of a 10-day stay in the public facility.
If someone were severely depressed, would you recommend a hospital like the second two, St. Luke's or Mobius?
The last place I would say would be your best bet. I think if you didn't have that option, then St. Luke's had some things to offer. But on the whole, I would say my advice is probably you're not going to feel tremendously better in a hospital. If you don't have another option, you must go. But I wouldn't recommend it. I would explore staying with family members, doing some of your own work with therapists and so on outside of a hospital.
In fact, you say that what you got from was $15,000 at St. Luke's you could have gotten from a vacation.
Yeah, you could stay in a very nice hotel, hire a private nurse, have very healthy food, and go consult a private therapist. You'd get all the things you got, and you could also exercise and get fresh air, and you could have the same effect.
What about the doctors you encountered? Were they better at the private facilities?
Well, I mean, that's what I found, certainly. I got lucky. I got a very good doctor at the second place that I went to who really was not arrogant and listened to what I said I needed, didn't push the drugs. When I said I didn't want to take them, he said, okay, that's fine. He gave me a pass to leave the grounds to go running, things like that were a great improvement.
You seem particularly disturbed by the lack of privacy, personal choice, and compassion at the Meriwether facility. That's the public hospital you stayed in. Was there a reason for so many restrictions, or was it just easier for them to handle all the people that way?
Well, certainly there were reasons. I mean, they take away a lot of the things that they take away, like pens, because they can be used as weapons, and I understand all that. And, of course, you can't have a private room in a place that's a public hospital, and ultimately that it's just that, you know, and there were reasons why they didn't want you to touch the other patients, you know, but ultimately what that meant was that you couldn't show this kind of affection, and I found that that affection and personal touch and listening even to my fellow psychotics, listening to their delusions and trying to enter their world, I found I was able to develop a relationship with them.
But I assume also you were helped by the fact that you saw this as a job that you were doing. You were writing things down. This was research. For most of the people who are in the hospital, they are just there because they're desperate. There's no other answer for them.
Yeah, and I guess what I would like to provide is an answer, a better answer. I think we've decided that mentally ill people should just be kind of shuttled away, and nobody in the community wants to take responsibility and say, these are our people. Okay, this person clearly has problems. Can we find a place for this person within our community? It's sort of like the local poverty solution. Can we each take a little piece of this and try to manage this? Because I don't think the answer is pulling that person entirely out, sequestering him away, making them feel even more alienated and separated.
Well, as you said earlier, it's good if you have a support system, but if you put them in a situation in which they're kind of isolated as often as possible to protect everybody, then it's counterproductive.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not saying it's an easy answer. It's not an easy fix, but then again, neither is poverty.
Were your fellow patients aware of the fact that you were a journalist?
No, I think some of them probably didn't guess that, but I think some of them said that they thought that I didn't belong there, or they wondered what I was doing there. Or, you know, in the second place, I was pretty openly writing in my notebook, and I think people wanted to know, you know, what I was doing.
No, you're talking about the patients.
Yeah.
The doctors, did they question your reasons for being there?
No, they didn't do so. I think it, you know, they figured, well, she is what she presents herself as, which is the predicament that they're faced with every patient. You know, I can only judge by what I'm seeing and what you're telling me.
A listener asked, what's wrong with taking medications to get through a tough patch, like a divorce or
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think it's a personal choice. What I would like is just for people to be better informed. If you're going to do it, just know that you may have some difficulty getting off it in 6 months. You may, you know, there are things you need to know about the side effects, the longer lasting effects. And then, yeah, it's absolutely a personal choice.
So what have you been doing since you left Mobius? Obviously, you completed this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been trying to, work on my own wellness model, which is really a daily practice of figuring out what are the things that make me feel better. I've been trying to get off my meds, which I'm almost entirely off of, tapering very slowly, and really paying full-time attention to staying out of that depressive state of mind, trying to use some of the things I learned at Mobius, for example, about cognitive therapy and watching myself, watching my brain work and trying to stop myself from going down the old paths.
What about taking a break from immersion journalism? It's what got you in trouble in the first place with the first book.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something I've considered, or at the very least doing something that's much more personally fulfilling. I think I'd like to construct something for the next project that's about wellness and personal fulfillment rather than kind of jumping into a scary situation.
Nora Vincent's latest book is Voluntary Madness, My Year Lost and Found in the Loony Bin, her follow-up to her bestseller, The Self-Made Man, which was a great success, but also led to real problems.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the success can also be a problem. This book is published by Viking, and I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.